Chapter 1. The Poison in Your Pantry. In this chapter, you will learn vegetable oils originated as byproducts of other industries, including soap making and confinement animal feeding operations. Vegetable oils require a staggering amount of processing to render them safe for consumption. Vegetable oil is more toxic than other oils and animal fats because of its chemistry. Eating a typical 5-ounce serving of most restaurant fries, which are nearly always cooked in vegetable oils, equates to the toxicity of smoking 20 to 25 cigarettes. There is a noxious substance in your pantry, and likely your fridge and freezer, too. It has an innocuous and even healthy-sounding name. It is ubiquitous in prepared foods and a staple ingredient in home-cooked meals. Chances are that you and your family are eating it every day. I am referring, of course, to vegetable oil, a substance that all of us eat, but too few of us know much about. That's partly because, though most of us grew up with vegetable oil in the kitchen, it is a relatively new food. A newfangled fat. In spite of its healthy-sounding name, vegetable oil doesn't truly come from vegetables like broccoli or carrots. It's sometimes more accurately called seed oil, because it actually comes from seeds. Both terms are used in common parlance, and I use both interchangeably as a blanket term referring to corn oil, canola oil, cottonseed oil, soybean oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, grapeseed oil, and rice bran oil, members of a group I call the Hateful Eight. Vegetable oil is an industrial product that didn't exist until a little more than 150 years ago. Before industrial agriculture changed our landscape, many human populations relied on animal fats, such as butter, tallow, beef fat, and lard, pork fat. Humanity has been eating animal fats since the Stone Age, and dairy fat for nearly 10,000 years. We've also eaten oils extracted from fatty fruits like olives and coconuts for many thousands of years. But vegetable oils are radically different. To start with, these new fats look different from the old fats. After processing, they are colorless, and they're dyed yellow to hide this. They taste different, they're almost flavorless, and making them requires technologically advanced equipment rather than a simple stone press or butter churn or butcher's knife. Yet despite their lack of flavor and the difficulty of processing them, they are now the largest single source of dietary fats, accounting for more calories in our diets than sugar or flour. To understand how they became so prevalent, let's take a look at the history of vegetable oil, which began not so very long ago. Why I call them the Hateful Eight. Neither the term vegetable oil nor seed oil works perfectly to indicate the problematic oils. This is why I created the term the Hateful Eight, which does. Each member of the Hateful Eight is hateful because of its chemistry. Chemistry affects how easily the oil is extracted, what happens during extraction and refining, storage, usage in cooking, the effects of reheating, how it changes in our digestive system, and how it affects our metabolism at low levels versus today's historically high levels of consumption, among other variables. Because not everyone is educated on the chemistry, you're bound to run into other people's lists of which oils are good and which to avoid. Just memorize these 8 oils, and you'll be good to go. Vegetable oil's origin story. The story of how vegetable oil became a staple in our diets doesn't begin with hunters in a forest or farmers in a field, like that of other substances we consider food. It begins with chemists in a soap factory. In the 1890s, facing a shortage of tallow to make soap, the soap and candle company Procter & Gamble turned to a byproduct of the textile industry, cottonseeds. Prior to the mid-1800s, cottonseeds had little commercial value because of their high concentration of an anti-nutrient called gossypol that causes dangerous spikes in blood potassium levels, organ damage, infertility, and paralysis. However, when the seeds are pressed for oil and that oil is refined, bleached, and deodorized, the gossypol is largely eliminated. Note, unrefined cottonseed oil is still used as an insecticide. Still, cottonseed oil was originally used not as food, but as fuel for lamps. When the petroleum industry emerged and petroleum replaced cottonseed oil as a popular lamp fuel, meatpackers began illegally adding cottonseed oil to animal fats, such as tallow and lard, to pump up their volume. It was also secretly added to American olive oil. It's worth pointing out that if vegetable oils were actually healthier than traditional fats, like tallow and lard, this would not have happened. It would be unusual for merchants to adulterate an inferior product with a superior one. When these practices were exposed, the sale and export of cottonseed oil were depressed. And with a surplus of supply, the oil was once again available on the cheap. Its low price made cottonseed oil attractive to Procter & Gamble. If the company could figure out how to turn it into soap, cottonseed oil would represent a low-cost source of fat to replace increasingly expensive tallow. By 1907, with the help of a German chemist, Edwin C. Kaiser, the company had succeeded. Kaiser contacted P&G's business manager, John Birchenall, about a recently developed method whereby adding hydrogen molecules to oily polyunsaturated fats would solidify them into saturated fats and trans fats. Oil could be converted into solid fat by a process called hydrogenation, which is still widely used today. Birchenall welcomed Kaiser to the company. Initially, P&G sold its solidified, hydrogenated cottonseed oil as Ivory soap. But when the company modified the process slightly, the product came out softer, more spreadable. Actually, it looked a lot like lard. So why not sell it as a lard substitute? The main challenge would be convincing consumers about the merits of this imitation food. Fortunately for P&G, this was still an era when, owing to the lack of regulatory oversight, advertisers could freely hawk their wares using any claim they might dream up. In 1911, P&G's marketing arm branded the company's newfangled cooking fat as Crisco. Crisco had no flavor, an attribute that P&G's marketing turned into a positive by calling it clean. The company promoted it to housewives as a healthier alternative to cooking with animal fats, adding that it could help ensure their children would grow up with good characters. Indeed, an earlier product called Cottoline, made from beef suet and cottonseed oil, had been similarly marketed as healthier, cleaner, and more economical than butter or lard. The scheme worked marvelously well. Crisco quickly superseded Cottoline in popularity. Even though Americans started consuming the solidified, hydrogenated oil in the early 1900s, our liquid oil consumption didn't change much. Many Americans initially rejected liquid vegetable oil. The 1904 U.S. Department of Agriculture's handbook remarked on an inexplicable prejudice against the use of vegetable oil. The problem was likely an unpleasant taste or smell from one or more of the process contaminants that could not yet be refined away. Hydrogenation is more intense and can eliminate those off-flavor contaminants. Thus, our liquid vegetable oil consumption stayed relatively flat until shortly after World War II. Changes to animal feeding practices dramatically spiked soy production during the post-war era. Americans were now eating more meat, poultry, and dairy products than they had in decades. Farmers had started adding soy meal to feed because it helped fatten up the animals at a faster rate, boosting profits. But animals couldn't digest soy meal unless it was defatted, a process that removed the oil. So, during the 1940s, for the first time in history, the majority of the world's soybeans were crushed to yield separate products, oil and meal. The oil was initially used to make plastics, but by the 1950s, major advances in soy oil refining greatly increased its acceptability in cooking and salad oils. Thus, vegetable oil has a unique history of being released into the food supply as a byproduct of two separate industries, soap making and confined animal feeding operations. Having advanced the processing techniques, scientists adapted lessons learned from refining soy and cottonseed to other members of the Hateful Eight. During the ensuing decades, corn, sunflower, safflower, and others made their debut in grocery stores. All eight of these oils are far cheaper to produce than animal fats and don't require refrigeration to reduce spoilage the way lard and butter do, making them immediately attractive to any business producing large amounts of inexpensive, convenient food. What's more, because refining strips away the flavor and most of the nutrition, these oils are chemically very similar, which makes them interchangeable, and this has supply chain advantages. So they caught on. A seed oil that bears special mention here is canola, a derivative of rapeseed oil. Rapeseeds have been cultivated for 3,000 years, but were unsuitable for human consumption due to erucic acid, a fatty acid that causes liver damage. In 1985, Canadian scientists identified a strain that was naturally low in this harmful compound. Because most seed oils contain mostly omega-6 essential fat, and canola is relatively high in omega-3, many people assume that canola oil is healthier than other seed oils. Unfortunately, chemistry says otherwise, as we'll soon see. Another reason that industrial oil seeds have caught on is their ability to grow in a wider variety of climates than traditionally cultivated plant oils. Coconuts grow only in humid equatorial tropics. Olives need Mediterranean weather, which only exists in 3% of the Earth's landmass. But soy, corn, canola, and sunflowers are highly adaptable and can grow in many climates all over the United States. Over the past 100 years, a large portion of our arable land has been given over to the cultivation of oilseed crops. Oilseed crops can also be used for animal feed, biodiesel, sweeteners, such as corn syrup, and processed protein powders. You may think these practicalities have nothing to do with human health, but they do. They determine what we grow in this country and what is promoted to us to eat, and that affects our daily dose. Procter & Gamble divested Crisco, Jif, and other edible products to other companies, and today no longer sells food. But having pioneered the use of ultra-processed oil as food, their legacy lived on. Next time you make a grocery run, read the ingredient labels. Just about everywhere, from the dairy case to the frozen food section and the snack aisle, you will see seed oils making repeated appearances. This is true of many products with an ingredients list, including salad dressings, canned fish, vegetable preserves such as sun-dried tomatoes, ready-to-eat foods in the deli section, diet drinks, coffee creamers, infant formulas, and nutritional shakes like Boost, Ensure, and Equate. You'll find seed oils in brands promising you they're organic, healthy, GMO-free, and Whole30 approved. No matter what kind of grocery store you're in, you'll find seed oils in almost every aisle. No matter where you dine out, you'll find them on the menu. We often hear that fast food is full of saturated fat, but precious few chains use expensive, saturated, fat-rich tallow, lard, or butter. And it's not just fast food. Vegetable oils now saturate fine dining experiences, and ethnic restaurants also take advantage of them, especially because vegetable oils cost less than healthier alternatives and don't contain the allergens or animal products that many customers want to avoid. These days, vegetable oil is a global industry. It generated more than $115.8 billion in 2020, and that figure is projected to increase to $162 billion by 2027. Candace Rossius is an industry insider who told me that the food service industry as we know it would collapse without vegetable oil. Ventura Foods, the company she worked for, orders shipments by the trainload. How vegetable oil is made. To keep up with the huge demand, vegetable oil refining takes place inside astoundingly large factories. From the outside, these factories are indistinguishable from oil and gas refineries, like those you see in the opening sequence of The Sopranos, as Tony cruises a section of the Jersey Turnpike above the infamously smelly industrial section of the city of Elizabeth. The process begins as the oil seeds are pumped out of the delivery trucks and into the factory via metal ductwork. They enter a series of large metal cooking and cleaning chambers that heat the seeds to between 400 and 600 degrees Fahrenheit several times in preparation for oil extraction. Next, they go into the extraction press itself, where the seeds are crushed through a large metal screw called an expeller that squeezes much of the oil from the meal. This first batch of oil emerges as a foamy, grayish-yellow liquid with a waxy texture. The crushed meal containing the solids and residual oil emerges as dark brown flakes, referred to as the cake. For now, the cake and the oil will go their separate ways. The oil goes straight to the crude oil holding tank, while the cake requires additional treatments to release the valuable oil it still contains. To release its oil, the cake travels into a solvent treatment chamber to be washed with hexane, a component of gasoline. The solvent removes all but 1% of the residual oil from the cake. The cake will be shipped off to a different building for additional treatments required to render it safer for its ultimate use as an ingredient in animal feed. The hexane-treated oil, now dark brown, will pass through multiple other chambers to remove most of the hexane and various solids. One important stage collects the waxes as they drain slowly into a grate in the floor. These will be processed into vegetable shortening. Next, the hexane-treated portion is reunited with the expeller-pressed portion in a crude oil tank. This crude oil is still not safe to eat. When I asked a process manager inside the industry, why not, he answered candidly, "Crude vegetable oil contains hydratable and non-hydratable gums, free fatty acids, partly oxidized coloring pigments like carotenoids, moisture, toxic oxidative components like aldehydes and peroxides, metallic elements, waxes, and other impurities." That's a lot to clean up. Refining the crude oil into a final edible oil is complicated. The American Oil Chemists Society, or AOCS, publishes a series of lengthy manuals to educate engineers and chemists on best practices for oilseed production. The flowcharts alone take up quite a few pages. Each flowchart maps out what's involved in each of the major processing steps: degumming, dewaxing, deodorizing. The list goes on. We'll discuss the deodorizing step again later in this chapter, but for the sake of chocolate lovers, I want to take a moment to try to help you visualize the degumming step in particular. The gum is a dark brown material that emerges from a 1-inch diameter steel pipe located about 2 feet above a cement floor. It plops into a receptacle bowl in gloopy segments, making it look for all the world like a machine having a loose bowel movement. That's where vegetable lecithin, an ingredient used in many brands of chocolate candy, as well as vegan mayonnaise, gets pulled out before undergoing its own set of extensive cleanup operations. Fortunately, the amount used in chocolate is tiny, so even though it faces the same safety challenges as seed oil, we'll see why shortly, it's not much of a dose. Entire factories may specialize in just one of these major steps. Most flowcharts illustrate between 20 and 40 different reaction chambers, each connected by what must amount to miles of tubes. I can't imagine that any ingredient requires more intensive processing than vegetable oil. Vegetable oil is big business, but only a tiny segment of the population eating vegetable oil knows anything about this giant industry. The industry was established by chemists, and it still relies heavily on chemists to oversee many aspects of production, not only for reasons of efficiency, but also to ensure the final product is safe to eat. Why vegetable oils are toxic. A brief chemistry lesson. So why does it take so much processing to make vegetable oils safe, or safe enough, to eat? It's because of their chemistry, which determines their stability. And their stability determines how easily they form byproducts during refining, and then during the cooking process, and finally, in our bodies. Fatty acids are the building blocks of all dietary fats, including vegetable oils, fruit oils, dairy, and animal fats, and our body fat. The three major types of fatty acids are saturated, monounsaturated, and polyunsaturated, often referred to as PUFA. Saturated fats are the most chemically stable. Polyunsaturated fats are the least stable because they're prone to reacting with oxygen, a process called oxidation. Monounsaturated fats resist oxygen reactions and are far more stable than PUFAs. A molecule called glycerol links three fatty acids together to form a triglyceride. The blend of fatty acids determines whether the triglyceride fat is liquid or solid. For example, vegetable oils are very high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, which makes them stay liquid, even in the fridge. Animal fats are low in polyunsaturates, as are olive and coconut oil, which makes them more solid at cooler temps. Olive oil should start to solidify in the fridge. What is a double bond? The term double bond describes how carbon atoms in a fatty acid molecule are connected to each other. They can be connected by single or double bonds. When a fatty acid has no double bonds, it's called a saturated fat, because each one of its carbons is fully saturated with hydrogen. Hydrogen blocks oxygen, preventing oxidation. So saturated fat is almost completely resistant to oxidation. Monounsaturated fat has one double bond, which makes it somewhat susceptible to oxidation. Polyunsaturated fat has two or more double bonds that are closely spaced together, making it far more susceptible to oxidation than saturated fat. This is why vegetable oil is far more susceptible to oxidation and toxin formation than butter, beef fat, and coconut oil, which contain mostly oxidation-resistant saturated fat. Oxidation is a familiar term to anyone studying chemistry. Combustion or burning is one of the most common oxidation reactions on the planet. Our modern world relies on the oxidation of fossil fuels, such as gasoline and coal, to power cars, trucks, planes, and trains, and to generate much of our electricity. These oxidation reactions make our lives much easier, even if they create toxins that must be avoided, like those in car exhaust. Consider trees burning in a forest fire. Their wood is not toxic until oxidation converts it into the blend of suffocating gases and particulates we call smoke. Similarly, oxidation creates toxins within our foods that weren't there to begin with. When we talk about toxins in our food, we normally think about one of two things: either natural poisons, like those in many mushrooms or foods contaminated with certain fungi, for example, or man-made toxins like pesticides, heavy metals, and industrial solvents. But the toxins we get from eating vegetable oils are neither naturally occurring poisons nor man-made toxic additives. The toxins in vegetable oils develop as a result of the oxidation of the oil itself. Oil oxidation creates brand new compounds within the oil that never existed in the seed. And many of these new compounds are mildly to extremely toxic. These toxins are not trivial. Many of them are listed in hazmat manuals and require gloves and gas masks to handle. Because acute exposure to them is known to cause damage to essential organs, tissues, and cells. The tendencies of oxygen to convert each major type of fatty acid into toxins is not part of the typical dietitian's curriculum, yet it makes the difference between an oil that's dangerously reactive and an oil that's safely stable. This chemical difference is the most important difference between vegetable oils and traditional fats. One principle can simplify our understanding of the relative toxicity of various dietary fats, the double bond principle. The number of double bonds in a fatty acid tells us how easily it oxidizes. The more double bonds, the faster it oxidizes. If the double bonds are closely spaced as they are in PUFAs, they're double trouble. Since oxidation creates toxins, each molecule of PUFA represents a potential source of toxins. Compared to animal fats and the fats in traditional cooking oils, such as olive and coconut oil, vegetable oils contain many-fold more closely spaced double bonds, and thus have the potential to form many-fold more toxic compounds upon exposure to oxygen. This is basic organic chemistry that has vitally important practical implications for nutrition science. These oxidation reactions effectively weaponize the polyunsaturated fatty acids, enabling them to convert bystander nutrients into toxins. This sort of thing can happen whenever we burn our food, generating compounds that tax our kidneys and liver as they work to eliminate them from the body, which is why it's not good to eat heavily charred food. When it comes to fats and oils, however, these toxic transformations can occur at temperatures lower than their smoke point. In fact, the much-touted benefit of high smoke point vegetable oils is actually not a benefit at all, because it's going to make your food less healthy than a low smoke point alternative, such as olive oil. Just to be clear, we're not just exposing our bodies to one kind of toxin, but to literally hundreds or even thousands of different types of toxins, some of them too fleeting for scientists to easily study, and that were almost unknown until recently, when they were identified thanks to new technologies. The kind and quantity of toxins that end up in the foods we eat will vary depending on processing, how often they're heated, and what other ingredients they're added to. Heating the oil during manufacture initiates toxin formation. More toxins form in oil that is exposed to light during storage. Still more toxins form when the oil is used to make food, whether in our homes, in restaurants, or in processed food factories. And even more toxins will form if the food gets heated again, as in leftovers. The most incredible thing about all these toxins is how fast they multiply. Just one single molecule of some of these toxins can set off a series of reactions that rapidly destroys billions of PUFAs and creates billions of new toxins. The generic term chemists use for all these toxins is lipid oxidation products, or LOPs, or LOPs for short. Think of LOPs as lopped-off pieces of PUFA. Toxin development works like a domino effect. One oxidized PUFA can quickly attack its neighbor, turning that PUFA into another LOP that attacks its neighbor, and so on. Chemists call this type of domino effect a chain reaction. Once a single PUFA falls, gets oxidized, the cascading dominoes rapidly oxidize one PUFA molecule after another at a rate of a billion molecules per second, leaving billions of new toxic LOPs in its wake. Once the chain reaction is started, only two things can stop it. One, simply running out of fuel, like knocking over all the dominoes. Or two, encountering chemicals that block oxidation reactions, called antioxidants. Antioxidants can stop the chain reaction of toxicity, sort of the way adding a twisted domino into the lineup of a long chain will interrupt the flow. The twisted domino diverts the energy off to the side, thus protecting the rest of the dominoes from falling over. Olive oil, peanut oil, and other traditional oils have been selectively bred for thousands of years to yield oils without industrial processing, so they are easier to extract using non-destructive methods that retain antioxidants, making them safer to cook with. Since the processing steps required to make vegetable oils edible remove many naturally occurring antioxidants, cooking with vegetable oils means the toxin-forming oxidation reactions go on for a longer time and do more damage. Another way to stop these chain reactions is with saturated fat. Saturated fat has zero double bonds and is very oxidation resistant. Think of these fatty acids like dominoes that have been glued down and can't be knocked over. Animal fats such as butter and tallow are very high in saturated fat, as is coconut oil and a few other uncommon plant oils, including macadamia nut oil. Why seeds aren't toxic, but their oils are. If vegetable oils like soy and sunflower oil are prone to oxidation, you may be wondering if the seeds are just as bad as vegetable oil. The answer is that all but one of the Hateful Eight oil seeds are perfectly edible. The exception is, interestingly, the first of the Hateful Eight ever sold as human food, cottonseed, which, as we heard earlier in this chapter, contains toxic gossypol. The reason vegetable oils are toxic but their seeds are not has to do with the seed itself, as well as all the intense processing we just covered. Seeds are dormant little plant embryos that can stay dormant for years, partly because they contain almost no oxygen. They also contain a variety of antioxidants that block oxidation during germination. The process of making vegetable oil strips away most of the antioxidants while exposing fragile PUFAs to intense oxygen, heat, and chemicals. If we made processed foods with healthier oils, the fatty acids wouldn't break down, and we wouldn't end up eating quite so many toxins. Of course, processed foods are still nutritionally impoverished, so I'm not advocating for this. Vegetable oil is the only food we eat that is so unstable it can't tolerate heat. Think about that. A cooking oil that can't tolerate heat, that oxygen tends to attack, and that we take into our oxygen-filled bodies. Describing all the toxins you expose yourself to from eating foods made with seed oils could fill up volumes of textbooks. Indeed, it has. And yet, relatively few people ever read these textbooks or learn about the damning information they contain. An army of oil experts agree. The squadrons of scientists supporting the edible oil industry work within a silo that few people even know exists. Almost all the science that industry produces is currently buried in technical journals, and these often sit behind firewalls of highly specialized, members-only, professional society publications. Few people involved in healthcare or medical research read these journals, or for that matter, even know they exist. Because these journals are so inaccessible, the media rarely pick up stories, even when they're damning, as we'll see later on. This prevents most people from ever hearing the truth. But if seed oil's toxicity is news to you, it's not news to the people in charge of manufacturing these oils. For over 150 years, edible oil scientists have attempted to prevent the fatty acids in vegetable oils from breaking down and forming toxins during their journey from field to fork. Their efforts have consistently failed. It's not that the edible oil scientists don't care about the healthfulness of the products they're in charge of manufacturing. It's that they've been handed an impossible task. Reading through chat groups dedicated to factory managers reveals a daily stream of questions requesting expert help with process problems and challenges in producing relatively toxin-free oils. Reading industry journals reveals a regular stream of scientists reporting on extremely high levels of seed oil degradation derivatives identified in common commercial products cooked in seed oils. And for the most part, the rest of the world has remained unaware of these problems. That said, some people have tried to sound the alarms. One of the most well-respected lipid scientists in the world, Dr. Martin Grootveld, has been trying to warn consumers about toxins in vegetable oils for decades. Dr. Grootveld is a professor of bioanalytical chemistry and chemical pathology, author of over 200 journal articles, numerous book chapters, and several books, and holder of many prestigious awards and grants. However, when I asked Dr. Grootveld if he'd ever been invited to present his data at a medical conference, he told me he had not. He studies oxidation reactions using the best tool for analyzing an array of different molecules all at once, a one- and two-dimensional nuclear magnetic resonance, or NMR, spectroscope. This analytical tool identifies molecules by magnetically jiggling the atoms and comparing the jiggling vibrations in the test material against known standards, thus identifying intact and broken or oxidized molecules by a kind of molecular fingerprint. He has tabulated the myriad toxins that develop in these oils whenever they're heated. His analyses consistently show that heated vegetable oils are loaded with toxic oxidation products, while heated coconut oil and butter contain hardly any toxins at all. Toxins he's identified include acrolein, which inflames lungs when inhaled, and many members of a category of toxin called epoxy fatty acids, which are involved in the pathogenesis of multiple organ failure and breast cancer and interfere with reproductive functions. Listing just the categories of toxins that he's detected in foods fried in vegetable oils would take up half a page. Remember those early 20th century housewives with their inexplicable prejudice against soy oil? They were probably detecting some of the more acrid odors produced by oxidized polyunsaturated fatty acids back in the days before a refining step called deodorization removed them. Deodorization removes a number of volatile compounds, including polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons like naphthalene in mothballs, and anthracene, a component of coal tar. However, removing smelly toxins from the bottled oil does not stop oxidation reactions from occurring, and brand new toxins slowly begin forming again the minute the bottle is exposed to oxygen-rich air. Even light can attack those double bonds and degrade high PUFA oils. Unfortunately, we can't count on our sense of smell to warn us, since we can only smell those that escape the cooking process as vapors. These volatile compounds tend to be smaller molecules and represent only a tiny portion of the total new compounds formed. Most of the toxins stay behind in our food, and many volatiles are odorless. But the label says organic. There are a few issues with the organic labeling of vegetable oils. The first stems from the two methods used to remove the oil from the seed. Mechanical extraction, which makes what is called expeller-pressed oil, and solvent extraction, which uses hexane. Hexane treatment automatically disqualifies the oil from organic labeling. But the expeller-pressed oil can be labeled organic, even though after extraction, it contains the exact same long list of contaminants and toxins as hexane-extracted oil, other than traces of hexane. The second stems from the deodorizing step. This step removes many malodorous and toxic volatiles that form during the earlier steps, but it also unavoidably converts a significant portion of the PUFAs into trans fats. How significant? Testing shows some bottles of expeller-pressed canola oil, for example, contain more than 5% trans fats as they leave the factory. But because they weren't purposefully added, these toxins don't count against the organic label. A more honest designation than organic would be hexane-free. Last, as these intensely processed, mildly contaminated organic oils sit on the shelves, they continue to oxidize. After you open them, they oxidize much faster. Toxicologists who perform real-world tests on vegetable oils in people's homes and restaurants find that even before cooking, and whether hexane-free or not, the oils contain significantly higher concentrations of toxins than they did when they were first bottled. Like all industries, the edible oil industry funds research to improve the quality of its products. Sometimes toxicologists and food scientists will even collaborate on the same grant. The food scientists can try out new ways of making the oil safer, and the toxicologists can test their work. Perhaps no one has tried harder to make vegetable oils less toxic than Dr. Eric Decker, professor in the Department of Food Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and one of the most highly cited scientists in agriculture. The focus of his work is preventing oxidation in our food supply, specifically in processed foods, and particularly vegetable oils, which he says are, without doubt, the most oxidation-prone ingredients in our food supply. This matters to the industry, partly because oxidation reactions ruin the taste of the foods produced, generating rancid off flavors, a leading cause of global food waste. The toxicity matters, too, to a degree. During his 40-plus year career, Dr. Decker has pursued many strategies to protect the fragile PUFA fats from oxidation during refining, cooking, and storage. He's tried adding all types of antioxidants to the oil, including vitamins, proteins, plant-based antioxidants, and synthetic antioxidants. He's tried keeping oxygen away from vegetable oils and foods made with vegetable oils by removing air from bottles and bags and replacing it with inert nitrogen gas. He's tried adding emulsifiers that reduce the oxygen-oil interactions. And he's tried layering a cloud of nitrogen over restaurant deep fryers. He's even tried rearranging the fatty acid molecules within individual triglycerides to see if that would stabilize them. So far, there's no great standout solution. At a 2022 conference attended by oil chemists around the world, Dr. Decker delivered the keynote presentation called "Why Does Lipid Oxidation in Foods Continue to Be Such a Challenge?" He explained that fully preventing harmful oxidation reactions that create dangerous toxins has proven difficult. Perhaps the most dangerous category of toxins is the aldehydes, the family of chemicals that includes the odorous cadaver preservative formaldehyde, and many of the toxins that make cigarette smoke irritating and carcinogenic. Toxic aldehydes that form in frying oil can end up in the food, and this is what keeps scientists like Dr. Decker up at night. Unfortunately, he is pitting himself against the inevitabilities of physics. Dr. Grootveld told me that the likelihood of ever making vegetable oil safe is about zero. Thermodynamics dictate that the concentration of polyunsaturated fat is directly related to the amount of toxins that will develop in the oil. It seems then that the only way to protect ourselves from toxins that form in vegetable oil is to avoid vegetable oils and to use fats composed of more stable fatty acids instead. There are degrees of toxicity to consider, too. The damage done to polyunsaturates by oxidation follows the same basic principles as burns on your skin, time, and temperature. The longer the oil is cooked and the higher the cooking temperature, the more toxins will form. Dr. Decker explains that when it comes to toxin production, the biggest risk factor is deep frying the oil. Deep frying stresses oils for a long time at high temperatures. Fast food chains create protocols for employees to reduce toxicity by, for example, changing the oil once a week, but smaller eateries and chains may not. Dr. Decker warns, "To me, The scary place to go is the diners and the small restaurants. In Germany, they regulate frying oil and test it for toxic volatiles during inspections. If the levels exceed a certain number, that's a violation, and vendors can suffer fines or other consequences. In the U.S., we don't even have a number set to define the acceptable level, Dr. Decker explained. And our government authorities don't test for toxins in frying oil during restaurant food safety inspections. But toxicologists have tested restaurant frying oils. One of the most well-studied type of toxins is called alpha-beta unsaturated aldehydes, now thought to be the most carcinogenic agents in cigarette smoke. In 2019, a paper in the prestigious journal Nature reported that a 5-ounce serving of French fries cooked in vegetable oil, from a well-known franchise, mind you, not one of those smaller restaurants lacking protective protocols, contains 25 times more of these dangerous aldehydes than the World Health Organization's tolerable upper limit for exposure. Dr. Grootveld points out that this amount is equivalent to smoking 20 to 25 tobacco cigarettes. A 5-ounce serving has about 25 fries, giving us an easy 1-to-1 correlation between fries and cigarettes for this particular toxic exposure. These aldehydes are potent mutagenic or DNA mutating, carcinogenic or cancer-causing, and cytotoxic or cell-killing agents. Still, they are just one of the many families of toxic compounds present in cooking oils. Why banning trans fats has been a public health flop. In the 1970s, the medical industry directed people to stop using tallow, coconut oil, and butter. Tallow had long been used in the food industry for frying, and we needed a replacement. So ingenious food scientists tinkered with the recipe for hydrogenated oils and designed a product, partially hydrogenated oils, that could better withstand high-temperature frying for extended periods. These contain trans fats. After doctors woke up to the harms of trans fats, they figured banning them would be a good thing and successfully lobbied to remove them from the U.S. food supply. The trans fat ban went into effect in 2018, but large chains had already removed them because of a New York City ban effective in 2007 and a European Union ban in 2008. By January 2020, U.S. food manufacturers could no longer sell products containing partially hydrogenated oils. Currently, they are no longer in the food supply to any appreciable degree. But that leaves restaurants no viable option other than filling their fryers with unstable, regular vegetable oils, as frying in animal fats has fallen out of favor. The trans fat ban has effectively doubled the consumption of liquid vegetable oil compared to what it was before the ban. In spite of its mild toxicity, trans fat resists oxidation, making it far less toxic than high PUFA vegetable oils. This is why food scientists, like Mart Matlock of ADM, a legal global producer of vegetable oils and fats for the food manufacturing industry, warned decades ago that banning trans fats and using liquid vegetable oil in deep fryers would expose us to a variety of toxic oxidation products. By all accounts, using vegetable oils in deep fryers will likely create a larger public health problem than trans fats ever could. Vegetable oils can contaminate more than just our food. They contaminate the air we breathe, not just in the factories where they're made, but in our very environment. After restaurants started making the changeover from trans fats, they dealt with fumes that formed a kind of lacquer on the walls and ceilings that couldn't be cleaned until the industry invented powerful new chemical solvents. The fumes also congeal and harden on workers' uniforms, and they have caused at least 2 laundromat fires when the flammable lacquer ignited into flames inside the heat of the dryers. People working over these deep fryers chronically inhale the toxic fumes and are at higher risk of cancer. Indeed, researchers in China have identified an alarming rate of lung cancer in non-smoking women using vegetable oils during pan frying, deep frying, and stir frying, both in food service settings and their own homes. Many people know deep frying is not healthy and avoid deep fried foods. That's why Dr. Grootfeld is more concerned about shallow frying, the industry term for frying food in a pan. It's different from sautéing, which uses less oil or no oil. He's published several papers in various prestigious journals warning that you can generate the same extremely high levels of hazardous aldehydic LOPs while making popular pan-fried or deep-fried dishes right at home. So it's not just about deep-fried food, and it's not just about restaurants. This could be happening in your kitchen. I asked Dr. Grootfeld if he felt that the food industry knew vegetable oil oxidation presented a potential public health problem. This was before I'd attended Dr. Decker's 2022 conference. Without skipping a beat, he told me, "They're aware of it, all right. They just don't want to do anything about it." He then proceeded with a story about a toxicologist who was obviously employed by the food industry that he'd caught sniffing around his laboratory and who'd asked him to change some of his conclusions in a paper about to be published that would expose a brand new category of particularly reactive toxins in vegetable oils. When Dr. Grootfeld refused, this industry agent tried to shoot down what we were saying by publishing an editorial in the same journal. Fortunately, Dr. Grootfeld stood his ground, and the journal editors ultimately backed him up. But it does make one wonder how often other, more easily intimidated scientists have been coerced into hiding the truth. The one thing to know about oxidation. Some of this chemistry we've discussed is complex, and you don't need to memorize any of it to understand the rest of the audiobook. The reason I've included it is to show you that its very complexity is partly why medical science hasn't been able to appreciate the toxicity of vegetable oils. Here's what I do want you to remember. Vegetable oils' tendency to oxidize has implications for everyday aspects of life that medical science has ignored. The implications are vast and profound. Indeed, the implications for medical science are so far-ranging that I have devoted my career to unraveling them. In the ensuing chapters of this section, we'll be doing that together.